Coming up on Golf Today, we chat with the head man of the DP World Tour, Keith Pelley. What is new in the partnership with the PGA Tour and a landmark decision by a UK panel regarding players in the LIV Golf Series? And the winning duo from New Orleans, Davis Riley and Nick Hardy, joined the program. How did they celebrate win number one at the Zurich, and have they recovered after all that fun? And who you got, Rahm and Finau or the field at the Mexico Open? You gonna back two big horses or take a look at the underdogs, games people play on Golf Today?
Golf Today.
Golf Today on a Wednesday. Damon Hack alongside Eamon Lynch, Golf Week magazine. Yesterday, we kind of tackled the PGA Tour and the structure of the PGA Tour Americas in 2024. Today, a closer look at the DP World Tour.
We just like to talk to the decision makers on this show, Damon.
That's what we do. Let's take a closer look at what's happened on the DP World Tour over the last year or so. June of 2022, strategic alliance with the PGA Tour expanded and extended through 2035. November of 2022, DP World Tour announces record prize fund and new earnings assurance program for the upcoming season. February of this year, hearing occurs to determine the outcome for LIV golfers who want to continue to play on the DP World Tour. And then April of 2023, so this is a few weeks ago, arbitration group Sport Resolutions rules in favor of DP World Tour, upholds its ability to sanction members who participate in conflicting events without a release. With more, let's welcome in Keith Pelley, the CEO of the DP World Tour. Keith, welcome. It's been nearly a year since the strategic alliance was expanded and extended through 2035. What has the alliance delivered to the DP World Tour so far?
Well, I think we had some real quick wins early. You know, obviously the Genesis Scottish Open was one of the biggest events we've ever had on the DP World Tour, with 14 of the top 15 players in the world playing last year in Scotland. We had another great win with the PGA Tour, allowing us to be part of Barracuda and Barbasol, where our players got an unbelievable opportunity to go to Lake Tahoe and play down there, and they've raved about it ever since. They've also brought new partners like Horizon, which allowed us to double the Irish Open in terms of our prize purse. So it's continuing to grow. They obviously have helped us with our record prize funds, and now they've released their schedule. We're looking at releasing our 2024 schedule at the Genesis Scottish Open, and there'll be definitely some new treats, some new tricks, and we're pretty excited about it, working closely with the PGA Tour.
Keith, there have been suggestions from some quarters that in some way the DP World Tour has been diminished by the Alliance, that it's become a feeder tour to the PGA Tour. What do you respond to that, and how can you be more specific in terms of what these new advances might be under this Alliance?
Eamon, I would say that I would be irritated by that comment would be a gargantuan understatement. It's a narrative that our staff is pretty well tired of hearing. You know, the fact that we have a pathway to the PGA Tour, which is basically a formalized pathway that's been there for years, is one component of what is a multifaceted tour with national opens, massive Rolex series events, the BMW PGA Championship. So, you know, a feeder tour is the Korn Ferry Tour, which has one specific goal, and that is to lead players to the PGA Tour. That is not what the DP World Tour is. So although we have a formalized pathway with 10 cards now to the DP World Tour, which we're thrilled about as part of our PGA Tour strategic alliance, our alliance is far more than just that. And as I said, we've had some quick wins, but really over time we'll develop a more cohesive strategy as we work closer with Jay Monahan and his team. But I tell you, that's the only thing that will irritate me, Eamon. And, you know, but that's okay. I'm over it.
Well, Keith, one thing that predates the Alliance is the Rolex Series. It was unveiled in 2017 under your watch, no pun intended. Stronger fields, bigger purses, with so much shifting sand in the game professionally. What is the future of the Rolex Series going forward?
Well, it is our premium category, and it will continue to be the elite of our 72-hole tournaments. Yeah. You'll see there, you see the schedule coming up. I think we will build on that going forward. And as I said, we're excited about what we're we're going to announce in at the Genesis Scottish Open, which is the third Rolex Series event there, as you see on the screen at North Berwick in Scotland, which is not far from Edinburgh. And that is something that we're working through, but we're going to announce our schedule some 4 months earlier than we've done before. Obviously, you can probably understand that our focus is going to come into the fall based on some of the FedEx changes, and that's what we're working closely with the PGA Tour on.
Keith, some of those previous Rolex Series events in the second half of last year had some LIV Golf players on there, much to the irritation of some European Tour members. You recently won the Sports Arbitration Panel decision in the UK that said you could sanction those members. Have any members of the DP World Tour resigned rather than pay any fines or sanctions that were imposed?
No, Eamon, as of right now, nobody else has resigned since the sports resolution hearing result. And the first component of that sports resolution result is that each player that played in the Centurion Club, which was the very first LIV event, must pay a fine based on them breaking our rules and regulations around our conflicting tournament release of £100,000. And that is due on May 3rd. So we will wait to see what happens on May 3rd with the players in terms of paying those fines. And then the subsequent ruling that Sports Resolution said was that we do have the right to enforce our rules and regulations. They're not anti-competitive. They're not restraint of trade. And as a result, we are now analyzing all aspects of our business with our board and with our tournament committee about what the sanctions will be for the players that have played without a release over the past year, both on LIV and the Asian Tour, and where we did not grant the release. We now can go back retroactively and sanction those players what we think is proportionate. The best part of the sports resolution ruling is that we can apply our rules and regulations, and they believe that the first sanction that we made of £100,000 fine to the players was proportionate. So we're delighted with the ruling, and now we still have a lot of decisions ahead. But as of right now, nobody has paid those £100,000 fines.
Two of the golfers who took that action initially against the DP World Tour, Ian Poulter and Lee Westwood, have said publicly repeatedly that they're trying to help the DP World Tour. Do you believe them?
Well, I think, Eamon, we both know that the contracts that they have with LIV are different than they've ever had before. And comparing LIV to the PGA Tour is like comparing apples to oranges. I would be remiss if I didn't say that I'm disappointed in the way some players have reacted. And I'm, at the other side, incredibly impressed with how some players have acted with the utmost class, in the likes of Louis Oosthuizen and Martin Kaymer, and some that have gone, understandably, have taken the eye-watering sums of money, but they have done so in a very diplomatic and a classy way. So I think that we will see what transpires over the next couple of weeks, and obviously there's a lot of questions around whether they'll be able to play in some of the Rolex Series events, as Damon alluded to. The bottom line is, I will let you know 100% that it will be their choice if they want to play on the DP World, continue their membership. We're not banning them. It will be their choice.
Keith, I was struck by your words after the decision by the UK panel. You said it was a landmark decision whose effect will go beyond the DP World Tour to other sports organizations. Why did you feel so strongly that this was a transcendent decision?
Well, because as a sports organization, and as all sports members organizations, and even non-members organizations, these are rules that were put in place by our members for our members to protect our members. And I believe, having gone through the actual hearing and the fact that they cited so many different other cases in history that both barristers brought to that attention, I looked at this and I went, they have said that we as a members organization and enforce our rules and regulations. And I believe that this case, when I say it's a landmark decision, it will be used in case studies, and I think it will be used in future, cases where organizations are having disagreements with their respective membership or their respective players, and they will cite this as an example and use this as why the panelists made this decision. So that's why I believe it's a landmark decision.
Keith, you and Jay Monahan have both recused yourselves from the official World Golf Rankings decision-making process on whether or not LIV will be awarded world ranking points. Why did you make that decision, and do you have any sense of a time frame when that decision might be made by the World Golf Ranking?
Yes, we recused both of ourselves, as well as Keith Waters, who's our chief operating officer, who represents the international tours. So there's seven members of the OWGR board. This decision in terms of world ranking points regarding LIV is now completely out of our hands. I'm not involved in the decision, not involved in the analysis of it. It will be made by the four majors. But I believe that the four majors, and even when before we recused ourselves, we were doing exactly what we should be doing in terms of good governance, is following the process. And that is actually taking any application that we have regarding world ranking points and turning that over to the technical committee. The technical committee is made up of a number of tours around the world, including the Asian Tour, and their CEO sits on the technical committee. They evaluate the actual application, looking at the criteria, and then they give that feedback back to the board, who determines the next steps. But at this particular time, I have not heard the feedback from the technical committee, and am not involved in the decision going forward.
Keith, I noticed you're wearing that beautiful Ryder Cup crest today. You know, it's just months away. For a while, it felt like it was forever away. Will the decision to allow LIV golfers to compete come down to the DP World Tour, the captain, Luke Donald? How do you see this all playing out?
Well, I see the fact that the Ryder Cup in Italy is going to be spectacular. That's the first thing. It's going to have... it's going to be sold out crowds. Italy is ready for it. Marco Simone is getting ready. It will be a spectacle, regardless of who the best 24 players in the world are there. I would say that, again, it comes down to their choice. There's only two ways to compete for Ryder Cup Europe, and that you have to be a DP World Tour member and you have to be European. However, there is a criteria that is two ways to get in via the criteria. One is you qualify, and two is you get one of the six captain picks. So in terms of qualifying, as you know, a lot of the LIV players have committed events that they're playing, or they're playing a lot of events on another tour. So that will make it harder for them to qualify. And depending upon what transpires with our sanctions, it will also potentially make it tougher for them to qualify through the rankings. So the only other way is if they get a captain's pick. And that is completely and utterly at the discretion of our captain, Luke Donald. He will choose if, in fact, he wants a LIV player to play. And I imagine he will choose on two criteria. One is if that player is in form, if they're playing well, and they can help the team. And two, whether it will enhance the chemistry of the team. But I can emphatically tell you that decision is solely at the discretion of Luke Donald. This will be my fourth Ryder Cup. And although I've had great relationships with the three previous captains, I've never influenced the decision, and I won't in Italy as well.
Keith, it's been an interesting few years in your job, to put it mildly. Given everything that's happened, do you regret having given the Saudis a place on the DP World Tour schedule back in 2019?
No, we brought the Saudis into the game in 2019 with the Saudi International, which was the first time that that a professional golf tour had played in Saudi. But I don't look backwards. I look forwards. That was part of our tour. The Saudis put on a great event for our members, and they did so in 2020. So I don't look back at that in any such way. If the Saudis wanted to get involved in the game, if they hadn't gotten involved with us through the DP World Tour, I believe they'd have found another avenue. So I don't regret that. I just simply look forward and go, what is the next step and how do we better our product and how do we better our tour through our relationship with the PGA Tour?
And then speaking of looking forward, do you ever see a scenario again where down the road you might end up working with the Saudis in golf?
Well, I think anything is possible. I think right now there are so many legalities and legal claims, and you know our sports resolution panel made a decision that we were very favorable. But you know what is happening in the U.S. that's still undergoing. So I think as long as there are so much legal feuds that are ongoing, I think it'll be more difficult. But you know, I've seen a lot in the last 2 or 3 years. I thought I'd seen everything in COVID, but then this maybe brought it to a new level. So anything's possible, Amy.
Well, Keith, it's a busy time in the game. We appreciate your time and thoughts, and we'll see you later on during the summer. Thank you.
Thanks, Damon. Thanks, Amy. See you guys.
The DP World Tour just wrapped a tournament in Japan. They've moved on to the Korea Championship in Incheon this week. Next week, it's the Ryder Cup venue, Marco Simone Golf Club for the Italian Open, followed by stops in Belgium for the Sudal Open, and then the long-established KLM Open in the Netherlands.
That was a lot of ground covered by the CEO of the DP World Tour. He seemed to channel the spirit of Seve when asked about the DP World Tour potentially still being a feeder tour.
It was
as if Paul Azinger had walked across his view in a Ryder Cup. But what did that tell you, just that pride in the DP World Tour and the quality of the players that they produce?
I think it shows a weariness at the narrative that's endlessly being thrown out there, not just by live players. You see it sometimes in sort of media loyalists who cover the European Tour for years, who have this idea that somehow the European Tour is being diminished. And you'll see some players even on the European Tour suggest that giving these 10 cards to their 10 best players as a pathway to the PGA Tour somehow lessens the impact of the European Tour. And the reality is, as long as that tour has existed, its best players have sought to play in America against the best players in the world.
Yeah,
it was very rare that you saw top European players who did not follow that pathway, at least to some extent. You go all the way back to Tony Jacklin 50 years ago. Mm-hmm. And Tony was doing that even before the DP World Tour was officially established in 1972. But the narrative that somehow the DP World Tour has sold itself to the PGA Tour when it should have sold itself to the Saudis has been peddled by players like Westwood, by players like Ian Poulter. And clearly, Keith Pelley is weary of having to defend that kind of commentary all the time.
Yeah, we saw his spirit there. We also see it every couple of years during the Ryder Cup, that kind of underdog spirit that the Europeans seem to find every single time these teams get together. Did anything he say surprise you just in terms of how this team might come together, basically saying this will be Luke Donald's choice? It may be a little more complicated than that, you'd have to think, considering all the relationships amongst the players.
Yeah, it's easy to focus on when he said it will be completely and utterly Luke Donald's decision, but then he laid out what the parameters are, and they aren't necessarily Keith Pelley's parameters. He talked about whether or not there's the chemistry within the team that Luke Donald would have to deal with. Well, there are quite a few players, potential players on that team, who've been quite vocal about not wanting live golfers on the team with them. So that would be a tough one for Luke Donald to get away with. But it's also the idea that they have to be DP World Tour members. And next Wednesday is when these fines are due retroactively for these LIV tournaments. And the odds that these LIV guys are going to pay those fines and retain their membership seems pretty slender to me. So I think a lot of these guys will formally take themselves out of the Ryder Cup question by next week.
Yeah, I get the sense that that's what Rory McIlroy would want. And I don't think he's alone in that thought. You don't want to kind of ruin the chemistry, do anything to disrupt what has been very successful for Europe, especially on home soil.
And team chemistry counts for a lot these days. We saw a lot of it actually at the weekend. We got two winners for the price of one on the PGA Tour. Davis Riley and Nick Hanley. They won the Zurich Classic of New Orleans, the only team event on the PGA Tour schedule. And both of them will join us right after this break.
Getting it done. First PGA Tour win for both guys, buddies, good friends. Bogey-free, 7-under-65 in the final round. And boy, did they close. They birdied four of the final six holes. In fact, they were bogey-free, 16-under for the final couple of rounds. Tournament record, 30-under-258. That's a lot of birdies, ladies and gentlemen. What do they receive? How about fully exempt through 2025? That means job security. You get the FedEx Cup points. This year's PGA. You get the Charles Schwab. You get the Memorial. Then next year's Century Tournament of Champions and the Players Championship. We got Davis Riley and Nick Hardy joining us on this Wednesday. Davis, I got a theory. The Zurich is a bit like the prom. You have these long-standing relationships like you two have, and then some guys pair up the days before. You pick the guy standing on the wall of the dance hall. How does your friendship manifest itself into good golf?
Yeah, you know, me and Nick have known each other for quite some time now, and I'm sure you probably saw a picture that had kind of resurrected a little bit when we played with each other at the 2014 Wyndham Cup, East vs. West, AJGA. So there's definitely some familiar mojo there. And yeah, we've known each other for a long time.
Nick, I'm curious how the nerves worked out on that day, because Davis has said after the tournament that he found it difficult to control his thoughts. You said you woke up that morning feeling like a wreck. Did you guys talk through the nerves during those final closing holes?
Honestly, not at all. That's something that I'm very proud of, is down the stretch, we really held it together really well. And we never got upset out there after one shot. No reactions after a bad shot at all. That's something I leave really proud of. And how clear we were thinking was awesome, too.
Nick, I met you for the first time at the Country Club last year, the U.S. Open. You just come off that injury, which you suffered, ironically or coincidentally, at the Zurich last year. What'd you learn about yourself kind of dealing with that setback and then bounding forward?
Yeah, I got off to a very poor start my rookie year, and then to get injured at the Zurich was really a damper on it. But I definitely bounced back really strong. I played great golf last summer, and especially at the Country Club. That gave me a lot of confidence. Getting to compete on Sunday for a U.S. Open was really special, and it definitely was a springboard for me the rest of the year.
Davis, neither one of you guys had shown a great deal of recent form coming into the Zurichs. What clicked for you that week? Was it the idea that you had someone else to rely on, or was it you had someone else that you had to step up for?
Yeah, sure. Nick would probably say the same. I guess I didn't get off to the ideal start that I really wanted to this season, but I started to show some pretty good form, had one or two nice finishes on the Florida swing. So I felt like the things were trending in a really good direction. And, yeah, I've been making a few changes, and I feel like this is a good week to really get the ball rolling. Like you said, there's a lot of really good tournaments coming up on the schedule that we'll be able to play, and we're really looking forward to those.
Davis, I'm curious how you navigated through all the fun that's on offer at the Zurich Classic. You got these food stops, beads, music, Sazerac, crawfish. Like, how'd you just navigate that and focus on the things and the task at hand inside the ropes?
Yeah, for sure. It's a different format, right? Because you're with one of your best buds. But I feel like that kind of relieves some of the stress a little bit, because it's not like you're switching groups every day playing with somebody different. You got your partner from Thursday to Sunday, and me and Nick being such good buddies, there's definitely a level of comfort there. And like Nick said, our attitude was extremely well all week, and I felt like we just kind of tried to stay in the moment and tried to be the best we could in every moment, and just kind of add them up and see where we stood at the end of the day.
Nick, we just heard Davis mention there about upcoming tournaments and how you guys are going to be a factor in those. Is that what's behind the reasoning for withdrawing, as both of you did, from the Mexico Open this week after the victory?
Yeah, look, getting to set my schedule now going forward and spend more time on my game and getting to practice a lot with this two-year exemption is huge for me. I feel like I've been scrambling a lot the last year, just playing a lot of golf since I was injured last year, and just scrambling to survive. But now having some security, and I'm sure Davis will say the same, security for the next 2.5 years is huge to be able to plan for the long-term future and getting better, and just like almost a reinvestment in my game.
Davis, how about that on the same note? I mean, we talked to Alex Baldwin of the Korn Ferry Tour yesterday, detailing some of the changes, PGA Tour, Latino America, and Canada becoming America's. What does job security mean with so many players that are kind of chasing you from the lower tours, as it were?
For sure. You know, there's definitely, you know, it's always a little bit in the back of your mind, right? Like if you don't get off to the ideal start of a PGA Tour season, then you feel like you got to press there in the middle. Yeah, it's nice having that comfort. We can kind of make our own schedule now. And having that security in the back of your head, I feel like it kind of relieves a lot of that stress, and we can kind of make our schedule and have that level of comfort there.
Well, Davis and Nick, it was a lot of fun watching you guys last week at the Zurich. Congratulations. We'll speak to you soon. Enjoy the week off. You've earned it.
Thanks, guys.
Awesome. Thanks, guys.
All right, folks. Well, the PGA Tour does head to Mexico this week. John Rahm heavily favored to defend his title. But don't sleep on 2022 runner-up Tony Finau. We dive into both of their odds and take a closer look at this week's venue when Golf Today returns.
This week marks the 63rd playing of the Mexico Open at Vedanta, but just the second time the tournament will be played as an official PGA Tour event. This is one of 9 international stops on the PGA Tour schedule this season, and the second of 2 in Mexico. Coverage begins tomorrow, 3:30 p.m. Eastern, on Golf Channel.
We flash back to last year, Vedanta. Tap in for the win. Popular win beats Wu and Finau by a single shot and snapped a 17-event winless drought. I've been hearing some doubters in the media and elsewhere last year, but those have seemed to have been put to bed since. A Masters champ is 5-2 odds. You see Tony Finau 15-2. That's the win this week. And kind of it's shaping into a bit of Rahm and Finau versus the field in these odds provided by our buddies at BetMGM. What do you think? Do you go chalk here? Is this one of those moments where Rahm and Finau are so decorated compared to everybody else that that's the safer play?
You mentioned there was doubt in the media last year. You're not seeing much doubt out of the bookmakers this year around as far as John Rahm goes. I'm taking the field.
You are?
This week. I think, you know, Rahm's coming off the tie 15 a couple of weeks ago at the RBC Heritage, his only start since that Masters victory. At a certain point, you think the weariness, the constant obligations that are now expected of a guy like Rahm, particularly coming off the Masters, is going to play a factor here. And Tony Finau, he's now gone 7 straight events without cracking the top 10 on the PGA Tour. You've got to go all the way back to the Farmers in January for the last time Tony Finau was in the top 10 on tour. Now, in fairness, he hadn't finished in the top 10 in 10 straight events before the Mexico Open last year and finished tied for second. But he just doesn't have a hot hand out there right now.
Well, the lack of the hot hand is with the putter. I actually spoke to him at Bay Hill earlier this year, and he said that he is hitting the ball. His ball striking is as good as it has ever been, just waiting for a hot putter. And he's watched the likes of John Rahm and Scottie Scheffler have those hot weeks with the ball striking and the putting when everything matches up. And that's what Tony Finau is waiting for. And considering his history at resort courses as well, a winner of the Puerto Rico Open, someone who has played in the weekend every week since the fall, it just seems to me that he's just waiting for that one good week with that most important club, and it very well could come this week. And then John Rahm is the defending champ, the best player in the world, and I think if I'm going to say he's going to win more than 4 times, we had that conversation as well in this season, no reason why he can get it done and win number 5 on the PGA Tour this season.
Well, I agree with you that Tony Finau is looking for that one good week. But you know who else is looking for that one good week, Damon? Every single player in the field. We just heard Davis and Nick talk about the hungriness of being out there and the desire to be able to control your own schedule. But you can't. You're out there scrapping for everything. There are a lot of hungry guys in the field this week. And this is a week they know they can feast. It isn't the strongest field in the world out there on the PGA Tour schedule by any means. And it is an opportunity for these guys. A lot of rewards come on a week like this. And I think there are a lot of hungry guys who don't necessarily rise to the prominence level, obviously, of a John Rahm or even of a Tony Finau. You look at guys like Wyndham Clark, guys like that. Those are people you ought to be looking at this week. There are too many of those guys in the field to just give all the attention to the top two.
There are a lot of guys like that. I'd throw Patrick Rogers into the frame as well. Someone who had a very good chance to get it done at the Valero Texas Open in San Antonio a few weeks back. Didn't quite get the job done there. But I tell you what, I'm going with the known quantities. I have Tony Finau in my one-and-done league, and I'm going to have him this week, and we'll have this conversation next week and see what happened.
Everybody wants John Rahm. Thousands of golfers dream of taking on guys like John Rahm and Tony Finau at Los Angeles Country Club this summer in the U.S. Open. Their journey is underway in qualifying as we build towards golf's longest day. One of those who has made the first cut in qualifying will be here with us next. Stay with us.
All right, folks. Hey, a new major champ was crowned on Sunday in case you missed it. Club at Carlton Woods, 25-year-old Lily Avu, UCLA Bruins, started the final round of the Chevron four shots back of the leaders, but rallied to win the first women's major of the season and got it done in that playoff over Angel Yin and took the leap. Tell you what. I see that blue and gold. It just makes me smile. Spent 3 years, did Lily, as a UCLA Bruin, was a Pac-12 Freshman of the Year, was a first-team All-American as a sophomore, won four straight events, a program first. Her junior season posted the lowest scoring average in UCLA history, 70.37. And now going to be in L.A. this week, JM Eagle L.A. Championship. She's among the notables in the field. I tell you what, we've talked about the far-flung LPGA schedule. When they do play, the field almost always, Eamon, is fantastic.
And they're playing this week at the wonderful Wiltshire Country Club, and it's one of several prominent stops in California for the rest of the year. They're also at TPC Harding Park next week. And then you see the two USGA championships, the US Open at LACC in mid-June and the US Women's Open at Pebble Beach Golf Links a little after July 4th. And qualifying has officially begun for that 123rd US Open this June at LACC's North Course. The process begins with 18-hole local events conducted at 109 sites in 44 states and Canada. Those players who advance will join a group of exempt players in final qualifying, which will be conducted over 36 holes at 13 sites between May 16th and June 5th.
All right, Eamon, let's take a look at U.S. Open local qualifying results as players try to qualify for golf's longest day presented by Titleist. There were five spots up for grabs on Monday at Coral Ridge Country Club, one of those going to Michael Buttecavoli, who finished the day tied for second. Well done, 34 years of age, played his college golf at Rice University, turned pro in 2010, and played on the NGA Pro Golf Tour and gained PGA Tour Latino America status in 2013. Four PGA Tour Latino America wins, the last coming in 2018. And Michael joins us now. We appreciate it. Congrats on making it through local at Coral Ridge. Just five spots were available. What's the stress level like on a day like that?
It's a lot less stressful now that I'm not doing it for a living. really just went out there. I haven't competed in probably over a year and a half. I stopped playing professionally and I tore my ACL, so I had to take some time off. And I really just went out there looking forward to playing golf. And it was a great golf course, which made it enjoyable as well. And at the end of it, I added them up and it was good enough.
It didn't look terribly promising when you were a couple over par through the first six holes, Michael, and then you played three under par the rest of the way. Was there a point where you thought the opportunity was gone, and then at what point did you realize you were back in the frame for a position?
That actually was flipped. I started on the back nine, so I was able to start off pretty well, and I made the turn at two under and three putted for double on I think my 15th hole, and was able to get one back on the next hole. And then we had a rain delay for probably about 30-45 minutes. And I was able to go back out and par the last two holes to finish at one under. I've never played the course before until that day, so I really didn't know what the number would be. And when I finished, I made about a 12-footer for par on the last, and I figured, okay, I guess I'll stick around and see where it leaves me, and it ended up being good enough.
Michael, you seem to have a bit of a laissez-faire attitude. As you told us during the break, you're in real estate now. As you said on the air, you don't do this for a living anymore, but what are the next few weeks going to be like as you prepare for final qualifying?
The few weeks preparing will probably be the same as my last few weeks. I just started full swinging maybe a month and a half ago post-surgery. I have a 7-month-old, a job. I'll play on the weekend and maybe try to get out there one day during the week, 2 days during the week. Fortunately, I'm a member at a great place in Miami Beach, Lagores Country Club, and it's easy for me to get out there and practice. It's just a matter of when I make the time. And like I said, I have a 7-month-old and he keeps me busy, and I enjoy spending time with him a lot more than I enjoy being on the golf course right now.
Michael, back in 2017, you made it to sectional qualifying for the U.S. Open and then had to withdraw when an airline lost your golf bag. How long did it take you to make peace with that? And what's your transportation plan to the qualifying next time around? Are you driving or flying?
I'm going to drive, assuming I get my first choice. I chose Pine Tree in Boynton Beach, which is probably give or take an hour from where I live. At that time, I was flying because I was coming from a PGA Latin America event. And so I had no choice but to fly to sectionals. So I don't expect any issues this time around. I've fortunately been able to play sectionals a few times over in Maryland at Woodmont, and I would have returned back there. It's an awesome golf course, but it's just a lot easier to be able to drive up to Boynton Beach, and I've heard nothing but great things about Pine Tree.
Now, Michael, I know you enjoy spending time with your son, and you are firmly in the real estate business now, but one of your wins on PGA Tour Latino America in Jamaica, I want to say you beat Harry Higgs and Tyson Alexander by 3. They're both PGA Tour members. You know, do you ever think about maybe giving the pro game another shot? You see what I'm trying to do here.
Yeah, no, I get it. I think about it a lot. You know, it's I played for a while, and it was tough to stop. I love to compete, and I miss competing. But I love my family, and I love my son, and I'd just rather be home with them right now.
Priorities are important to find in this life, Michael. When you have changed your priorities away from week-to-week grind of competition and you find yourself in this position heading to final qualifying, does that temper your expectations in any way in what to expect?
For sure. You know, I was practicing 6-7 days a week before. Now it's not very often, and I'm coming off an injury. So a few days ago was the first time I've walked 18 holes in a long time. So there's not a ton that I expect. At the same time, anytime I tee it up, there is that competitor in me. Anything I do, I like to do it at a high level, and I strive to do it at a high level. And so I'm sure there's a little bit of discomfort knowing that I'm not as well prepared as I typically would be when I was practicing and playing all the time. That in itself will probably lower the expectations a little bit, but once that tee goes in the ground, I know that I'm gonna do my best and fully expect that if I play well, that I'll be playing in the Open at LACC.
Well, Michael, best of luck in final qualifying, and more importantly, your son is very lucky to have you as a father. Enjoy it, because it goes
Thank
very
you.
Fast. We'll speak to you soon.
Yes, it does. Thank you, guys. Appreciate it for having me.